This is the 12 Songs of Christmas, today with Chuck Mead. My name is Alex Rawls, and 12 Songs of Christmas is my podcast exploring Christmas music and the way it fits into the careers of the people who make it. I'm calling this episode the start of Season 2 of 12 Songs. I planned on running the show year-round, and that remains my dream. But in the spring and summer, it became hard to get guests, life caught up, and I began dropping episodes sporadically. Finally, I decided that for the foreseeable future, 12 Songs should run from Labor Day through Twelfth Night. And since Labor Day has passed, the show is back, and will stick to its regular weekly schedule. I will slot a few encore presentations of good conversations I had late last winter and early spring to help them get the hearing they deserve, and I've got a few more plans that I'll share when they come to fruition. Today, I'm talking to Americana singer Chuck Mead, who we first met as a member of BR549. BR549 played Western swing, rockabilly, country, and hillbilly music starting in the mid-90s when they were signed by Arista Records. Chuck tells some of the band's history in the interview, so I won't go into it too much here, but they were signed during one of those moments when country record labels listened to the people who wanted country music to sound the way it used to. Then they discovered that country radio and a larger part of the audience really liked what country sounded like then. And so while BR549 and the Mavericks, who were signed at the same time, sold respectably, they didn't sell or get airplay like Garth Brooks or Trisha Yearwood, who were contemporaries. Chuck eventually went solo and has released 4 albums since, including Close to Home, his most recent, which came out in June. He recorded them in some legendary studios, including Memphis Sam Phillips Recording Studio, where he cut the new album. It made sense after he served as musical director for the Broadway musical Million Dollar Quartet, based on Elvis, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Johnny Cash in Memphis. But there's only a little Sun Records vibe on the album. Really, it's a continuation of the aesthetic Mead demonstrated from the start, with songs that draw from all the sounds, including rock and roll, that were once considered part of country, and now live under the big tent of Americana. The album is smart, well-crafted, and a lot of fun, which is true for everything I've heard from Mead. I asked him to be part of 12 Songs because he recorded Christmas music with BR549, and a version of country singer Eddie Arnold's Will Santa Come to Shantytown in 2012. So we talked about all of this, including how that song inspired a track on Close to Home. Let's get to that conversation. This is Chuck Mead on 12 Songs of Christmas. I know you're from Lawrence, Kansas. What was the music that you grew up with there?
Well, because it was a college town, we had a lot of music in that town, you know, a lot of rock and roll, a lot of country. And because we were 45 miles from Kansas City, we had a lot of blues music too. And so I was lucky at the Lawrence Opera House, which is now called Liberty Hall, within the span of a year, I saw in the same place, Muddy Waters, Clarence Gatemouth Brown, Charlie Daniels, and the Cramps, all in the same place.
Oh, that's great.
And so like, and then there's for some reason that reggae was really huge around there too. And so like I saw Third World and Burning Spear and Muda Baruka, and Peter Tosh, you know, it was like I had a pretty well-rounded musical environment. You know, my family was musical, and so I knew all the old rock and roll and country. I played in my folks' band when I was a teenager.
Okay.
I played drums, and I got to sing the rock and roll, the Chuck Berry stuff, you know. And we played Elks and Eagles and Knights of Columbus and places like that. And so I grew up with my folks type of music, which was, you know, country and, you know, Hank Williams and Carl Perkins and Elvis and stuff. And so, you know, and then whatever was on the AM radio at the time, you know, the Ooga Chaka version of Hooked on a Feeling, one of my favorite tunes ever.
Absolutely.
You know, that was a time and a place where anything could happen.
I'm so glad. Actually, I'm going to stop you right there. I'm so glad you said that, because I think people today who don't know what AM radio was, particularly in the 60s and 70s, really miss something. Because I think about listening to AM radio in like the middle 70s, and how you could hear Alice Cooper and Roger Whittaker and Rick Dees' Disco Duck and
Kenny Rogers.
And Kenny Rogers all back to back. You could hear great music. You could hear T-Rex. You could hear that if, you know, whatever you were listening to, give it 5 minutes. And if you don't like what you're hearing, you could hear something entirely different.
Yeah. And it was before all the marketing people got really into it.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because that's what it is. It's just like, oh, well, if we just play this kind of music, then we could sell this stuff to them.
Sure.
And it just got consolidated. And, you know, now it's, you know, you hear the same shit over and over again on the same station.
Right.
You can't tell one from another. But yeah, you know, that's why, you know, I'm a big fan of the Brothers Johnson and the Spinners too, because of all that.
Right, right.
And the Commodores, it was all on the radio. Music is supposed to be communal to me. Because that's how you relate to other people through music without, you know, that's why you can go anywhere in the entire world and sing the first line of, Almost Heaven, West Virginia. I swear to God, doesn't matter where you are, everybody in the whole place will be singing along with that.
Right.
Even if they don't speak English.
So with all that musical background that you had in Lawrence, how did you decide that Honky Tonk was your place?
Well, that's what I grew up playing. With my folks' band, you know, we play, you know, some of the songs that BR played down on Lower Broadway, I just learned from my parents' band, you know.
Oh, wow.
It was, you know, we played the country hits of the time and from 50s and 60s. And because my uncle was a rock and roller, you know, we played, you know, Carl Perkins and Elvis and Eddie Cochran and Chuck Berry to, you know, to go along with the dance, go along with all the Hank Williams and Don Williams and Satin Sheets and everything. My mom sings Satin Sheets every single show, you know, and so that was my background. But when I got to be, you know, a guitar player and a teenager, you know, I wanted to play rock and roll. And then the whole 70s resurgence, you know, what they called the punk rock movement came in, you know, with the Ramones, which was a lot more variety in the 70s than what it became in the 80s. Punk rock, you know, you had different bands doing different things. You know, you could like Nick Lowe and Rock Pile, you know, that's part of my, you know, and the Beatles, you know, big, huge Beatles overriding everything. Best damn rockabilly band to ever come out of England, the Beatles.
Right.
And, you know, I wanted to play rock and roll. You know, I wanted to be, you know, I was young and I wanted to play rock and roll. And so I kind of had these pop bands because I was really into The Who and all that. And I was, you know, trying to be that. And then Jason and the Nashville Scorchers came through town. And they were playing country music like punk rock, but they had great songs. Jason wrote terrific songs. And just that energy. And I realized that I could be, you know, like I would have these parties. We had these big parties at my house. I lived in a rock and roll house. Right. And I would always put on Hank Williams or Bob Wills, at, you know, 2 a.m. to see who my real friends were. And with, when I saw Jason and those guys, it, it put it together in my head that it doesn't have to be just one thing. It could be something. It all parts of me could go into one thing. And so then that helped develop what I wanted to do, which is what I'm doing now.
Well, that's great.
Which is whatever I feel like.
Now, I think I want to get, what I was curious about is, you know, I know you signed with Arista in 1995, and it was one of those moments where I think if a number of sort of more traditional, country or country acts were signed, you among them. And I remember, you know, kind of wonder, do you remember or have any memories or strong memories about that time, what it felt like to be in that moment where, you know, a major label saw a future for you?
It was sort of a whirlwind and a surprise. You know, nothing was ever planned. And we were down there, and we were having crowds out the door lined up all the way around to the Ryman, you know, to get into our bar. And we didn't feel like anybody was even noticing us from Music Row. But what we didn't know was that there were scores of managers and label people in there watching us do our thing that were waiting for us to take a break. And we never did. And so the ones that stayed till 2 a.m. were the ones that we ended up going with, you know. And it was weird to be like just some chump playing in some crappy bar in a dilapidated street that was a lot of fun. And then suddenly you look around and we're on David Letterman, you know.
Right.
And that's the power of a major label. And I'm standing there shaking hands with Clive Davis, you know. And it was a little bit jarring, but it was fun and it was exciting and it was a great time. And but there were other, you know, at the time it was a whole scene, you know. There were people coming up like Jesse Dayton and Dale Watson and the Derailers, and there was just a whole slew of us that were called alt dot country,
right?
Because evidently we were alternative country because we were playing country music, you know.
Right.
Big Sandy and the Fly Ride Boys, everybody had a pretty good record deal back then. And because there was you felt that there was some sort of momentum leaning that way. Now, you know, of course, you know, we all got, it didn't go over the top. That's what Steve Earle said, yeah, you were part of that third wave of the credibility scare in this town.
Right.
I was part of the second wave of the credibility scare in this town. And the first wave was like Guy Clark and Chris Christopherson and Willie Nelson and all those guys. But you know, I the thing that we always were reiterating is that we weren't really against anything. We weren't against, you know, some of the stuff that we didn't really dig that was being coming out in the mainstream, but we always felt like that there should be room for all of us.
Summertime, 59, in my world was kind of mine. At 10 years old, I was a battle wound. They see my bottle picked up food. I'm with me, I never did give a damn. I guess you could say it was a hillbilly thing. I survived 65, but I must have been the luckiest man alive. 16 years old, raising hell. Got some tales too tall to tell. Hanging at the gas station, me and the gang. I guess you could say you were the hero of the day.
Was that hard to deal with when you realize the reality of here's what the country radio business, you know, is going to remain, and that it really, they're the country, that labels may hope for one thing for you, but radio really doesn't see it?
Well, everybody wants a hit record.
Sure.
And they're lying to you if they say they don't. But it was a little frustrating for us because there were certain people at Arista that were like, you have to get on country radio. But then there was a whole other team at Arista that were like, no, it doesn't matter. It's about worldwide domination. Because, you know, one week we'd play a string of shows with George Jones at little arenas. And then we'd play with Tim McGraw and Faith Hill. And then the next thing we do is we go on tour with the Black Crowes for a couple of months. And, you know, you're reaching a whole bunch of different people then. And we were playing the same thing. We were doing the same thing. It's just that people understood what we were, that we weren't bullshitting them. We were really doing it, you know? And so in that sense, it was frustrating for us when they, you know, it was like, you guys have to go visit a radio station on your one day off that you've had this month. Right.
Right.
And so we trudged down there because it was always like, well, if you don't go down there, they definitely won't play your record. They're not going to, they won't for sure if you do, but they definitely won't if you don't. So I remember going to this one station in Memphis. And it was, we were all tired as hell. We just wanted to like hang out in Memphis and walk around. But we had to go to the radio station. So we all get up and we go to the radio station and we sit in the reception area for like 25 minutes with, you know, waiting on the program director to grace us with his presence, you know. Finally, he calls us into his office and we're sitting there and he goes, hey, you know, I know people who really dress like you guys. And I said, well, we dress like us. And he said, no, I mean, really. I mean, I know you guys are just made up. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I mean, how insulting, you know. And then we get to talking and he says, well, we really can't play your record. You know, we don't even play Johnny Cash anymore. It's kind of nice how he's come around, you know, and this is in the 90s when all that Rick Rubin stuff was coming out. He's back in rock and roll. And, you know, we can't take a chance on playing your record. We listen to it. And then Jay pulls our CD out completely unopened. They hadn't even listened to it. And I'm like, well, you know, it just takes somebody with a little balls to do something a little different. And the guy's like, well, you know what happens when you stick your balls out sometimes, someone snips them off. And I said, is that what happened to you? And of course they did not play our record.
Right.
but fuck that guy.
Yeah.
Can I say that?
Yes. Yeah, we're good. Yeah.
You know, and we got a lot of support, like Buck Owens. He owned like 3-4 radio stations and he always played our record. He was a big fan. He supported us a lot.
That had to be gratifying.
It totally was. We got to be good friends with Buck. He'd hang out with us, you know, because Donnie, our fiddle player in BR, he lived in Bakersfield for quite a while. And so he knew a lot of people and Buck knew that he had come, you know, had lived there for a while. And so there was a connection. And of course the BR549 connection, you know.
Right, right.
That goes without saying. But he loved us, you know, and so we did get a certain amount of support, but you know,
what do you think are the meaningful differences between the music you were making then and the music you're making now as a solo performer?
In BR549, we were trying to take Roberts to the world,
right?
You know, because we had created a whole little thing down there, you know. Unbeknownst to us, really, we didn't know we were creating anything. We were just setting up and playing, and the people came, and it kind of happened. It was circumstances beyond our control, really. The cosmos, I don't know how it all happened, but, you know, we did that. And with my band, I can kind of make the decision on what the vision I want to take, you know, instead of saying, hey, you guys want to do this? And trying to make decisions and then someone isn't really into it, even though it might be a really good idea. And so we don't do it, you know, and with having the freedom of being a solo artist, you know, you can kind of call your own shots. You know, this is what I want to do. I want to go to Memphis and record. What do you guys think about this? You got it, you know, and they're like, well, sure, you know, whatever.
Right.
How much does it pay?
Yeah.
Well, actually, they don't say that really, but, you know, they're on board. And but then it's an enormous help having those guys make me look good night after night.
Now,
you know, and in the studio.
You've recorded Christmas music with both BR549 and on your own. Why did you decide to record Christmas music?
Well, when BR549 recorded It Came Upon a Midnight Clear, it was because Arista was putting out a Christmas compilation. So they said, well, you guys got to come up with a Christmas song. So we did the Louvin Brothers version of It Came Upon a Midnight Clear.
It came upon the midnight clear, that glorious song of old, from angels bending near the earth to touch their harps of gold.
We did the first reunion show. Gary had come up with a Christmas song called a Truck Stop Christmas. And so we went into a little studio after a rehearsal for the show and put that down. You know, we hadn't recorded, we hadn't even been in the same room together for 10 years. And we went in and recorded a song, you know, and it was like falling into an old saddle or something. You know, we all went to our places and we did our thing.
Nothing to do but wait. I parade in red tail lights in front of me. The snow is assaulting down 12 hours from my hometown, and this ain't no way to spend a Christmas Eve. A billboard back there said there's a truck stop up ahead. So I decides to pull her over, get my hunger fed. I fumble for my phone, cause I shouldn't be calling home to tell her I can't make it, but I've not a worse regret. But it looks like this is gonna be a truck stop Christmas, miles from where I really wanted to be. And I hate to know how they'll be missing me. It's gonna be a truck stop Christmas and a lonesome Christmas Eve.
I wrote a Christmas song, which is called The Holiday Song. And I don't know, I think we talked about this before. Yeah. I don't know if I, did I ever send that to you?
I've found it and I want to talk to you about it in a minute. But I before we get too far forward, I wanted to stop for a second about BR 549, because was one thing I'm always curious about when you, you know, when you do things like Christmas music, was everybody equally on board to do Christmas music, or did anybody need their sort of arms twisted a little?
Well, no, it was just something that you did, you know, that, that the label wants you to do this. So go in and record this and, you know, choose a song and do it, you know, and the A&R people signed off on it. And, you know, it wasn't that much, because that's just what you do. You, every now and again, you make a Christmas record. I mean, right. Everybody does it, you know.
Sure.
Daddy looked a lot like Santa.
Yeah.
Santa looked a lot like him. And you know, I happen to be one of the few people who love Christmas music. I never get tired of it around the holidays. People get burnt out on it. But, you know, my birthday is December 22nd. So when I was a little kid, to me, all the bright lights and happy music, that was all about my birthday shit, you know. You know,
that's great.
And I really I can't wait for November to come around. And, you know, I love hearing Christmas music. And, you know, the people talk about the war on Christmas. Man, it ain't going anywhere. What are you talking about? You know, who cares if you say happy holidays or, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter. That was around when I was a little kid. You know, you're not trying to take anything away from anybody just by trying to include everybody in the holiday season. You know, different people have different holidays. And that's why I wrote my holiday song. Because, I, you know, Christmas is about togetherness and giving. You know, ultimately.
When
I was just a little tyke, and the holidays rolled round. When mistletoe and lots of snow and pretty lights abound, I didn't know that friend and foe were celebrating too. All the races, Christian, pagan, Muslim, and Jew. But nowadays we're always fighting over Christmas cheer. It's all the same except the name, so we should make it clear. 'Tis the season for some reason, let the goodwill ring. With just one simple word this year that all of us can sing. Oh, Ex-Maquana, Hanorama, Krista Kadanzamas. We all want good and brotherhood and peace on earth for us. This time of year that brings good cheer should sound a lot like this. Merry Ex-Maquana, Hanorama, Krista Kadanzamas.
What was the moment when you knew the holiday song would work?
I have to give credit to my wife, because she was the one that came up with the Ex-Maquana, Hanorama, Krista Kadanzamas.
That's where I was going with this.
She was the one that came up with that. And so she just kind of left it in my lap. That's what she's really good at. She comes up with something really brilliant and then says, okay, now go do it. And so I did, and I started thinking about how to make it. And the only thing I could think of was a little rap that went along with it. So, and because I only had that one chorus, I had a couple of verses and a chorus, and that would have been boring. So I made a nice little story out of it.
Right. How long did it take you to learn that phrase to the point where you could sing it?
Actually not too long, because it kind of rolls off. Ex-Maquana, Hanorama, Krista Kadanzamas. It's spelling it that really throws people.
Yeah.
You got to spell it just right.
Yeah. I actually had here a note. Could you, you know, do you still remember the word? So clearly the answer is yes.
Oh yeah. You know, we don't play really many Christmas shows because around the holiday season, Marty Lins, our drummer, has a band with Jen Gunderman, who plays keyboards with Sheryl Crow, and James Haggerty, Hags, who plays bass. He plays in the Autumn Defense League, and he's played with the Blues Brothers. And, you know, he's got a career too. They have a band called The Ornaments. And for like the weeks leading up to Christmas, they play two shows a night, and they do the whole Vince Guaraldi, Charlie Brown Christmas record back to back, front to back.
That's excellent.
And that's not easy to do. And they have guest musicians, and it's always really, really great. And so we're kind of off during that period because Marty's doing that. It's so popular.
Oh, good for him.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I go to the show every year. It's a tradition with us now. My folks flew down last year to go to the show, you know, because you just walk out of there feeling so great after that Charlie Brown Christmas music. You know, I never get tired of it.
So
I don't get a chance to sing that song very much, although I have occasionally. Maybe this year we'll try to do it, you know, because I think we got a show on December 7th before he goes into all the ornament stuff. So maybe I'll try that out then. You know, we'll have to practice,
right?
Because I gotta fit all that rap into a certain amount of time. I gotta practice that.
So I have to ask you, because that after thinking about you and Christmas music, I was thinking, do you know Charlie Rich's Santa Claus's Daughter?
No.
I was thinking you would be great at singing Santa Claus's Daughter.
I have to check that one out.
Yeah. You really do. Charlie, I mean, first off, it's Charlie Rich, so how awesome is that? But also, yeah, it's a great Charlie Rich
awesome.
Rockin' tune. Yeah, I love Charlie Rich. So
I'm writing it down now. Charlie Rich, Santa's Daughter.
Santa Claus's Daughter. Yeah.
I'm looking that up as soon as we get off the phone.
Okay. So I saw a video of you performing Daddy's Drinking Up Our Christmas with BR-549 with Marty Stewart.
Right.
Do you remember what year that was?
I think that was 96.
Okay.
Because that was like right after we had our record deal, and that was a particularly spacey performance, because when we went out to film that, we had flown back from Japan. We had played a show in Japan. This guy named Charlie Nagatani has a big festival there called Country Gold. And we had been over there, and we flew back and like went immediately from the plane from Japan out to Opryland to film that show.
Wow.
And we did Silver Bells and Daddy's Drinking Up Our Christmas. And we did a little shtick with Little Jimmy Dickens, and Willie Nelson was on the show. It was the Marty Party show.
Right.
And we'd played that a few times down on Lower Broadway, Daddy's Drinking Up Our Christmas, and you know, to a lot of groans, like, that's a terrible song. Because there was a lot of daddies in the bar right then. You know? But I still think it's one of my favorite Christmas tunes. I think we got that off of a Commander Cody record.
I love it. It's a classic. Let's go.
One, two, three.
Daddy's drinking up our Christmas. Gonna be some hard times this year. No tree or stockings or presents. Just bottles of Christmas cheer. No new Frigidaire for Mama. No toy train for Brother Jim. But Daddy's drinking up our Christmas. Don't know what's gonna become of him.
And I always wonder, you know, kind of what the thought process is as a musician when you're deciding, like, for instance, like, what Christmas song are you going to do? Because in this case, like, that's the first time I heard it was hearing you do it.
You know, when we were down and playing on Lower Broad, we always played our own music, but we had to fill 4 hours. And so we played what we knew, which was Hank Williams, Buck Owens, Johnny Horton, Ray Price, you know, Bob Wills. And I think that the thing about it is that if you're in a rock and roll band and you're playing covers, you're just a cover band. But if you're a country band and you play country covers, you're just a country band.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not,
sure,
it's not held against you, but you get extra points because you're playing original music, for me anyway. And so a lot of the covers came out of what was in our musical history and vernacular between Gary and me and the other guys in the band. But you know, we always concentrated on writing songs and getting better at that. And, it really didn't matter. You know, that our first single was a cover. We covered, it was Johnny Horton's version of Moon Mullican's song, Cherokee Boogie. And, you know, I chose that because I wanted to play it down on the street, you know? And you would come up with new songs because people would request something that was kind of obscure, and you'd go check it out and, yeah, I can handle that. You know, let's do that. And then we'd have a new song or I know a couple of verses, you know, I'll go back and learn the rest of it later.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, nowadays I do try to choose the right cover because I have enough material now that I could play, you know, 2 hours of my own songs or more. And that's fine. So I kind of have the freedom to choose what I want to play, you know,
right.
If I want to pull something out that's weird, like, you know, last week we did The Letter.
Cool.
because I felt like it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think choosing well-chosen covers are always a wise decision.
Sure.
You can't just go out there and play anything. And you have to surprise people.
Right.
And make them happy. Like, I remember one time on Lower Broadway, I don't know, for some reason, we ended up playing Jet Airliner.
Wow. Wow.
And everybody knew that song, and it was a joke. I think somebody requested this and gave us money, you know, as a challenge, and we went right into
right.
it. And one night someone requested the Ramones, and so I pulled out I Want to Be Well by the Ramones.
Wow.
And, you know, Donnie and Gary had never even heard that song, but I wish we had a recording of it because Donnie had the coolest steel part on it. He wouldn't believe.
Wow. So I was thinking about, you mentioned Truck Stop Christmas, which Gary wrote, and, you know, and I wonder with especially with BR-549, where your central proposition was so much about sort of honky-tonk music, if there came a point where it was hard to speak sort of as yourself in that context, because I mean, those, you know, between Truck Stops and Drinking and Crying in Your Beer, like those two Christmas songs go straight into the, kind of straight into the brand. And I wondered if there's a point where it's hard to speak as Chuck Mead and not as, you know, honky tonk guy in that band.
I don't know. I guess a little bit. You always get strapped down by the image and all that. But to me, it was just, we did that. It was our image. We did it. It was accidental. That was just what we wore. You know, that's what we looked like. And that was what we did. But again, it just all comes down to a band dynamic, you know.
Sure.
It's a collaborative thing. You can't put your feelings too much over everybody else's because it's everybody's band. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe there's some just stuff that I didn't do in BR just because I didn't feel like it fit in BR, but I'd never felt like I was constrained by it at all. I mean, after a while, I think everybody did because, you know, it got to be a weird dynamic, but you know, in retrospect, really, there was very few things we did that we didn't want to do.
That's cool. So you also recorded Eddie Arnold's Will Santa Come to Shantytown.
Will Santa come Shanty down to a poor little boy like me? Will he bring me some toy like the other girls and boys? Will Santa come to Shanty down if he sees our Christmas tree? Mama said he would if I promised to. Christmas rolls around. Will Santa come to Shantytown?
Yeah, that was another thing. That was the guys at Plowboy, Shannon Pollard, who owns Plowboy Records, who's Eddie Arnold's grandson, was had a great idea, and actually Cheetah Chrome from the Dead Boys was our A&R guy at the time.
Oh, that's great.
Which is kind of weird. And he came to me and he's like, yeah, we're doing this Christmas. We're trying to get this Christmas song cut. And I really want Jimmy Cliff to do Will Santa Come to Shantytown, you know, which is perfect for Jimmy Cliff to do. Right. Because
right.
That's Shantytown too. And it would have this, it would have a really great emotion, but you know, they couldn't work it out with Jimmy Cliff. So he said, well, you guys want to give a whack at it? You know, sort of a, you know, rock steady version. And so we did kind of a rock steady country thing and on that. And it turned out so well that I ended up kind of writing a song with a buddy of mine that on my new record called I'm Not the Man for the Job, which is, you know, Marty Linz describes it, our drummer describes it as Rocksteady from San Antonio. So you know, it that kind of led us to something that was original. And I really enjoyed that recording session. That was a great day. I remember it, you know, where it was kind of a shuffle, but kind of a, you know, reggae rock steady, early pre-reggae, I guess.
Sure. Did you ask Cheetah what the thought process was to get from Jimmy Cliff to you?
I was in town and I just recorded my first record for those guys. So,
yeah,
or actually I hadn't yet. They were trying to get me on the label at that point. He really wanted me to come over and make a record.
Have you thought about making an actual Christmas album?
No, not really. I don't, you know, to me, a whole Christmas album would be, I don't know. People have tried to do it and make new Christmas music, but people just want old Christmas music.
Sure.
You know, and maybe you can pull off one song, but to try to pull off a whole album full of just, you know, I guess the Mavericks did a pretty good job of it. A couple of years ago, they put out a Christmas record, but mm-hmm. I really don't have that much interest in doing it. I mean, I love Christmas music. I love listening to it. It's just that I don't think, you know, it would be hard to pull off something of all original Christmas music.
Sure. One quick note. In there, we heard the Luvan Brothers version of It Came Upon a Midnight Clear, because Arista Records' Star of Wonder, where the BR549 version appears, is out of print both physically and digitally. I also included it because I like it. You can reach me on Facebook at 12 Songs of Christmas. You can find Chuck Mead at Chuck Mead, also on Facebook. Let us know what you thought of today's conversation. Personally, I like using the excerpt of the Marty Party spot that included Daddy's Drinking Our Christmas Away, and I'll include a link to the video in the show notes, because the clip actually starts with some stagey conversation with Marty Stewart, who I can't get enough of. Thanks to AF the Naysayer for the 12 Songs theme music, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Alex Rawls, and we'll finish with Eddie Arnold's version of Will Santa Come to Shantytown. Talk to you next week.
Will Santa come to Shanty Town to a poor little boy like me? Will he bring me some toys like the other girls and boys? Will Santa come to Shanty Town if he sees our Christmas tree? Mommy said he would if I promised to be good, for we don't